From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. It was just a couple of days ago that Capital New York released their exclusive report on fracking. Not a, really a report on fracking per se, but a report on the study of fracking. The Cuomo administration had commissioned the U.S. Geological Survey to study the environmental effects of fracking and the potential concerns for water supply. And what Capital New York found through various Freedom of Information requests and other information was that the report had changed over time. We've got a chance now to talk to Scott Waldman, the reporter who teased out this story and finally, after a lot of back and forth, has published his results. We welcome Scott to Connections. First of all, Scott, give us a sense for what exactly the study is. I mean, we hear all kinds of different study, but right there in the headline, Cuomo administration edited and delayed key fracking study. Which one and who put it together?
Okay, so the study was important because it is the environmental benchmark that you need if you are going to begin fracking. Other states, including Pennsylvania, have sort of wished they did this step before they allowed fracking to go ahead. And what it is it's measuring naturally occurring methane levels in water sources in the gas-rich area of the state, which is, of course, the southern tier. One of the outcomes potentially from fracking that could occur is methane pollution. When you start drilling in one place, naturally occurring methane could migrate to another, and you have a higher concentration than is natural, and that can lead to pollution and even destruction of drinking water sources. So this study was basically that first benchmark that you needed to begin fracking.
And the study was conducted from when to when?
The study, it was ordered in late 2011. The state commissioned the U.S. Geological Survey to conduct the study in late 2011. That is a time when the Cuomo administration was actually saying somewhat publicly that they were going to allow fracking in the southern tier in some of the key five counties there. And then it was underway during 2012, which is a time when the administration, when the governor in particular, shifted his rhetoric from allowing fracking to, well, we're not sure, we're going to study the health effects, to 2013, when he was basically saying, we're studying the health effects and I have no idea when we're going to be finished studying the health effects. In December is when the study actually finally came out. And the challenge for the administration is once you order a study from the U.S. Geological Survey, it has to come out. So what we see here is that they sort of tried to potentially doctor the results.
Doctor is a strong word. Is it possible that the administration would say, look, as the study progressed, there were initial concerns about methane and water sources, but the more we studied it, the more our initial assessments and our initial concerns were lessened?
Yes, they certainly would claim that. They haven't really spoken to me much about the story, so I'm not sure exactly how they would spin it. But it's worth noting that some of the pieces of this study that were excised from the rough draft that I obtained and the final draft related to both pipelines as well as underground gas storage, which is, of course, a big issue in the Finger Lakes region where there is a proposed project to store liquefied natural gas underground and methane and others. Basically, that was removed. References to methane pollution from those methods of transportation and storage of natural gas were removed from the final draft. And then another sentence was inserted into the final draft, which sort of downplays the risks of fracking. It says that basically the pollution risks are mitigated if there's proper casing on the wells. So to suggest that the science itself was corrupted by the administration, I think, is not what the story is doing. The U.S. Geological Survey is the gold standard when it comes to scientific studies. But some of the parts where the editing occurred, and again, the emails I obtained were heavily drafted, so I don't know exactly what the administration occurred. I just knew that they had a high level of interaction here. Some of the areas where the editing occurred are basically selective edits that specifically gear the study towards the southern tier and allow it to touch on some of the other pending projects before the state, projects that the governor hasn't decided on, even though it's been 5 years.
Talking to Scott Waldman from CapitalNewYork.com, his story, Cuomo Administration Edited and Delayed Key Fracking Study. Is it an oversimplification then, Scott, to say that when the study was progressing, the initial concerns relayed by the people creating the study or scientists were lessened in the final draft after the Cuomo administration intervened?
No, I don't think that's a leap at all, and that's sort of how this story has been received in the last few days. So I think a lot of people have drawn that conclusion, environmental groups most notably. I got a number of statements yesterday from environmental groups picking up on this and saying it shows that the state is preparing for fracking here. They're trying to downplay some of the risks. And this means that the state is going to allow fracking after Election Day. You know, I'm not sure if that's true or not. I don't think anybody can say with any certainty if that's true or not. But it does suggest that there is, you know, a downplaying of the risks here on behalf of the administration.
We're looking also at the legal landscape and the court ruling from earlier this year that will cement home rule. So even if the Cuomo administration, as you say, or an Astorino administration allows for fracking, the courts have said that local municipalities can enact bans that will stand legally, just as an aside for our listeners who might be wondering. But when it comes to this particular study, were scientists concerned that the Cuomo administration was dragging its feet releasing it?
They were. And again, the emails are heavily redacted. They claim this was privileged information, but some of the pieces of particular emails I could read, they were actually, the spokeswoman for the U.S. Geological Survey saying basically that we need to release this now and that it has to come out in a timely fashion. We can't keep delaying it. So no one at either the federal government or the state government will confirm that that's what's happening, but it's sort of there in plain English to see that the Federal Geological Survey was concerned that the state agencies, which is the Department of Environmental Conservation and the New York Energy Research and Development Authority, were needlessly delaying this.
You're a journalist and you're not a columnist or an analyst here. Your job is to report what you find and the public is going to do with it sort of what they will. But I'm curious to know, you have environmental groups looking at your report saying that this is a smoking gun, that this shows that scientists were concerned about the health effects of fracking. They expressed that in a report, and after the Cuomo administration intervened internally, the final report showed much less of that concern reflected. They're saying it's a smoking gun. Are you comfortable with that description of the report, or do you think that that's hyperbole?
I don't think it's hyperbole, but I think smoking gun may be a strong term. This is in a highly closed administration. This is the kind of tea leaves we're left to read. So I can't say anything definitively, but sources told me that there was a high level of interaction here, which is why I foiled for this in the first place. And this is of a piece with some of the administration's interactions and other commissions and studies in the past few years. So does this mean the state's going to allow fracking? Well, the state already said it was going to allow fracking, and now it's sort of been in a period of delay. Everybody knows that that's a political decision. In fact, recent polling suggests more and more people see the administration's claims that there's a necessary health study that has to happen before fracking takes place. More and more people are seeing that as a political decision on behalf, political calculation on behalf of the governor. And, I think that there's certainly a strong argument for that. But the administration did already say that it wants to allow fracking, at least in these southern tier counties. And some of the industry folks that I've spoken with in the past few months, particularly since that home rule court decision came down that you referred to earlier, some of those folks say that, there you go, that allows fracking to take place. The governor can say, well, I'm going to allow it to take place in this limited area in the southern tier, and if you don't like it, your community, well, you have the right now to say that you're going to ban it within your borders. So you can see this, the governor can sort of have it both ways. You can have a limited allowance of fracking to say that he, you know, didn't cut off a key economic engine for the state, and he can sort of tell the environmentalists, look, you know, I'm allowing it to be go forward only because it's heavily regulated.
When I say environmentalists are using this as a smoking gun, I should characterize that properly in that they're not saying that this is proof that the Cuomo administration wants to allow fracking. I don't think that that's much of a secret, and I think your analysis is correct. Even legislators, Joe Morelli has told me that certainly paves the way for the Cuomo administration to say, yes, we'll allow it where you want it, and it's up to you. The environmentalists who say this is a smoking gun are saying this is proof that the state knows that fracking is dangerous, but they're trying to cover up just how dangerous, and I'm wondering if that is a leap.
Again, you know, I don't want to weigh in terms of opinions with whether I agree with any particular, you know, advocacy group or not, but I can see why they would draw that conclusion. it inserts a line about fracking being done safely, but also there's a lot of science behind this. This is a fairly academic study, and the actual science isn't corrupted at all in this. It's just sort of the summary statements that set up the raw data that have been edited. Whether or not that is the smoking gun that environmental groups claim it is, I mean, I guess I'll leave that up to them. But I can certainly see why they come to that conclusion.
You've had to deal with a lot of Freedom of Information requests, as you've said, and even after your Freedom of Information request to the Cuomo administration, much of what you received did have heavy redactions. Are you comfortable with that? Did you think what was released to you was fair and thorough?
No, I didn't think it was fair at all. And the Cuomo administration did not even release the original contract that came with this. Thankfully, the federal government follows the clearly obvious Freedom of Information laws in what they release. And in this case, they did release the full contract. That contract also clearly states that this is done. The study was done so that it was a pre-drilling study. In other words, it was that benchmark that was needed. The state apparently didn't want me to see that language. They did not release that part of the contract to me. So they released a total of, I think, about two or three emails to me, whereas the federal government released dozens of emails. So the federal government also heavily redacted them, claiming that it was privileged information, which I would take umbrage with. But it is certainly important to note that the state barely released anything here, and I foiled two state agencies, both the Department of Environmental Conservation as well as NYSERDA, and they didn't think that hardly anything was worth releasing.
But Scott, is that par for the course with the Cuomo administration in your experience?
Yes, and I think that's why stories like this get attention, because reporters struggle greatly to document what happens behind the closed doors. It's extremely difficult at times, but as we saw with the Moreland Commission reporting by both the Daily News and the New York Times earlier this year, there is a lot of interaction that happens behind closed doors that is extremely important to note, and it's unusually aggressive in this administration. I'm not the first to say that.
Scott Waldman, CapitalNewYork.com. The story, Cuomo Administration Edited and Delayed Key Fracking Study. You can find it online now. We'll post it on our Twitter account. Scott, we appreciate your time, and I know we'll talk to you and your colleagues soon.
Thanks. Take care.
Coming up in our second hour, getting off the beaten path, we talked to the folks from Slow Road Video and Travel Communications. They are going to be talking to us about what you might not realize about Western New York. There's a new rail series designed to show us some of the highlights of Western New York this time of year, combined with the local agricultural industry. And they also think outside the box on touring our region. That's next hour.
You may want to start packing your bags because WXXI has your ticket to win an amazing adventure during the 2014 Travel Raffle. A limited number of tickets are now available where you can win your choice of one of three unique travel experiences. For complete rules and information, go public at WXXI.org/raffle. Supported in part by New York Pass and Amaya Indian Cuisine.
I'm Evan Dawson. Welcome back to Connections. Peter King is a name you might recognize from the world of radio. He was in Rochester about 20 years ago, working here, and has since gone on to, well, bigger and better things, I think we can say. No offense to Rochester, of course, but he's a CBS radio correspondent. He's covered the space industry, anchors some national radio newscasts, and he's got a new book on Ithaca Radio, looking at the history of all the great names that have come through Ithaca. Many that might surprise you, especially in the mid to late 1970s, have a chance now to talk to Peter King. Well, we welcome not only Peter King, but also Scott Feibusch, a WXXI contributor and editor of Northeast Radio Watch. Scott, nice to see you.
Always good to be here.
And Peter, it feels like you're in studio with us, but you're actually broadcast. Are you at home today?
I am in my home studio in lovely, hot, sweltering Orlando, Florida.
It's a wonderful setup for you to have there. And for all the people who hear your voice, they may not realize the modern conveniences. I wonder if the Peter King from the 1970s would believe that you are broadcasting out of home.
Not in a million years, and nor would I have believed that I'd be broadcasting at the network radio level out of a house in Florida. I mean, in 1974, when I first started in this business, you know, that was kind of like the farthest thing from my mind. And the things we get to do thanks to technology are pretty amazing.
Well, we're going to be talking about some of the really exceptional talent that went through Ithaca and the Finger Lakes in the mid to late 1970s. In fact, the man who wrote the introduction for your book, Keith Olbermann, says that he would stand by the talent from the mid to late 70s in Ithaca compared to any large market at any time in broadcasting. And when you start to see the names, Peter, I don't think that that's necessarily hyperbole.
Oh, I don't think that's hyperbole at all. We had, even during my 4 years there and my brother's 4 years there after me, the quality of talent that started there, that went through there, was pretty amazing. I don't know if you want to go through some of the names, if you want.
Well, I think that's part of the fun here. And before we even do that, yeah. let me also say that you realize that Peter must have met everybody, either in Ithaca or even before then. I saw on Twitter, Peter, that you even met the great Don Pardo before you even got to Ithaca.
I did, and that was when I was a high school student and growing up near New York City and going to NBC to watch TV tapings all the time, and sat near him during a Jeopardy taping.
When
Jeopardy was a daytime show with Art Fleming. And you know, I caught the radio bug really, really early in my life. I mean, most people in our business these days want to go into television. And that was also true back in the day. I mean, there were radio nuts, there were TV nuts. But I like the idea of radio. We talked about technology a second or two ago, where, hey, you could be on the air with a simple telephone call. And there was something that really struck me as being very simple yet very romantic in a media kind of sense to be able to do that. And I said, well, you know what? Imagine the possibilities.
The book's called Ithaca Radio, and Peter and Scott Feibusch are going to be out on Thursday from 11:30 to 1:30 at Bill Gray's on Penfield Road, talking about the book, signing copies. And the book is filled with great stories, beautiful pictures. Scott, let me ask you, and I'll ask Peter kind of the same question, especially from his personal perspective, but give us a sense of the radio and the broadcasting landscape from 1974-75 through the 70s as it existed, especially in Ithaca.
One of the neat things about Ithaca, you know, one of these markets that didn't have local TV. And so radio in a market like Ithaca that's down there in the valley, you kind of have to have cable or a big antenna to see or hear anything from out of town. And so everything that happens locally on the radio, that's it. That's the big time media in town. You've got Ithaca College that is churning out these graduates right and left who are going on to big things in the field, and you've got radio stations in town, not just the commercial stations, but even the college stations, that are sounding like big market stations that have incredibly professional people on the air, even though they're only in their 20s, who really know what they're doing. That's not always true of college radio then, or especially now, but it was true of Ithaca then, and it created, and Peter, maybe you can talk about this a little bit, this pipeline that went from Ithaca to the big time, and in a lot of cases came right here through Rochester along the way.
Well, Scott, and you also can't give the short shrift to Cornell, because Cornell has turned out some amazing media professionals, as you'll find out in the book. I mean, when I was there alone, I mean, the Ithaca College roster of people, you know, reads like an all-star game, if you will, but Cornell as well. For those who aren't familiar, WICB was the Ithaca College radio station. WVBR was owned by the Cornell Student Guild, which means it was actually independent of the university, not officially affiliated with the university, but broadcasting for a long time from university digs, and now has broadcast in its own facilities now for several decades. They just moved into a new one last fall. There's a picture of it in the book, of course. There's a picture of everything in the book.
Sure is.
Of course. But you're right about the Ithaca radio being the big-time media in those days. Sirachi Cable was the only way we could bring in TV signals from out of town. And at Ithaca College, we had a TV station that broadcast on the cable, so that was our chance at the big-time TV world one night a week. That was Sunday night. But otherwise, you know, there was the Ithaca Journal. There were other print media, the New Times in those days, the Cornell Daily Sun, the Ithacan on the IC campus. And then you had radio. And WTKO, which was one of the two big commercial stations in town is where many of us developed our talents. WHCU, AM and FM were the others, and they actually were owned by Cornell. So there was a lot of Cornell-oriented programming on both stations, but it was basically kind of a hodgepodge. I mean, you might have a talk show in midday. You might have middle-of-the-road music later on. In fact, one of my friends who was a part-time DJ there got in trouble for playing Rock the Boat by the Hughes Corporation because that was too too contemporary for their tastes. And WHCU had a legendary morning guy named Jack Deal who was on there from the early 1940s until 1981. And he was out of the mold of those, you know, the old-time radio guys who played the piano and organ and sang and read letters from their listeners and things like that. But he was an institution there. On WTKO, that was a bit more contemporary. In the 70s, we had what we called full-service radio, and that is, you know, Top 40 radio, which also did a lot of community service, which also did a lot of news. So you had disc jockeys, you had news people, and you had, you know, the other infrastructure that you needed a commercial radio station. It was, in many ways, it was like perhaps a mini WABC or a WLS, that kind of up-tempo presentation, but, you know, very much tailored for its local audience. It was an awful lot of fun to be there in those days. I was listening to some tapes of myself that I haven't listened to probably since 1977 or 78 or so, and it was like, how did I ever get on the air there?
Well, but let me ask you, Peter, because I think of my own college and radio days. My first broadcasting job at Ohio University was from midnight to 6 a.m. on the Rock Lobster. It was a cable radio campus station only, so you could reliably know that six people or fewer were listening between midnight and 6 a.m., and So there wasn't a whole lot of policing. You know, you could try to get away with silly things, and I did, and I won't admit on right here on the air what they were, but who was who was policing? You know, were there occasionally, we're going to have fun with this, we're going to throw things at the wall and see if it sticks? Was there sort of a hierarchy of command structure that said you can do this, but you can't do this?
There absolutely kind of sort of was. And by the way, I like that you're an Ohio University Bobcat.
Yes.
My wife is a Bobcat
yes.
as well, so she will be proud to know that. At WICB, when I started, we were 10 watts, but we ran that station as if it was a 50,000-watt blowtorch and everybody was listening. That said, there were transgressions from time to time. A great guy who works in radio sales in Rochester played an album cut by Loudon Wainwright III called Rufus is a Blank Man. And you can use your imagination to come up with the body part, because I don't think you want me to say
no,
that.
No, probably not.
Here. Got a little bit of hot water for that. My college roommate in 1975, well, he wasn't my roommate then, but became a roommate later on, he played, at that time, Natalie Cole, This Will Be, you know, the song that's now on the eHarmony.com commercial all the time. Well, he was so excited about that, he said that the song gave him an orgasm on the air.
Said that on the air, okay.
He said that on the air. He got in a little bit of hot water for that. But for the most part, you know, things that happened were accidental. There is a classic track from Harry Nilsson, you may recall, from the mid-70s, called You're Breaking My Heart, You're Tearing Me Apart, So Blank You. Well, somebody didn't realize that was in the lyric, and it went on the air very briefly and went off the air just as fast.
Yeah.
But in the mid-70s, it was kind of a top 40, almost middle-of-the-road top 40 format. We had jingles, we had imagers, you know, just like real radio stations, if you will. And we treated those 10 watts with an extreme amount of respect. When we went to 5,500 watts in early 1976, oh my God, it was like, hey, we could like reach Elmira. We could almost reach Binghamton. Hey, they could hear us past Cortland. And The format's refined. It evolved into an album rock format in those days. And, you know, these things kind of come and go cyclically, if you will. The WVBR format with the Cornell Student Guild for the longest time was classic rock. In those days, it was album-oriented rock, but with a very, you know, free-form yet professional presentation. They had a couple of incarnations as CHR, Contemporary Hit, or Top 40 Radio, and now they're back to an album rock format, which has been most of what they've done for the past 40 or 45 years.
Well, and when we talk about, Scott, going from 10 watts to 100, in today's context in 2014, we may not fully understand that there wasn't nearly the competition and the noise, and so when you go to 100 watts in, say, the 1970s or 80s, that was a big deal.
Well, and there wasn't streaming either.
Right.
And so you either had to be right there in Ithaca to hear this, or it didn't exist as far as you were concerned. And now all of a sudden, you know, for our listeners who are tuned in on WEOS, this is now a signal. If you're in WEOS land, you can probably hear some of these signals out of Ithaca, too, on a fairly regular basis. It expands the area that you're covering, the number of people you're talking to. But I want to get into, Peter, some of the names that came through. I mean, going back, you know, even before your time there, some names that people in Rochester know very well. Jessica Savage came out of Ithaca Radio.
Jessica Savage was one of the few women on the air as a disc jockey during the 60s. She had problems getting on the air at WICB while she was an Ithaca College student. She wound up getting hired at the old 95 BBF. And by the way, that was a station we all wanted to work at. Man, what a great radio station that was. And she was hired at BBF as the Honeybee. And she did commercials, she did jock shifts and all kinds of stuff there, long before she went into television and really made her mark there. So, yeah, let's see. Nick Nixon is a name that you will know.
Next name I was going to bring up, actually.
Nick Nixon, who is now the voice of the two-time Stanley Cup champion Los Angeles Kings. Well, Nick Nixon was a senior, I think, when I was a freshman in 1974. And we're talking about Nick Nixon Jr. now, for those who have been around for a long time. His dad is a longtime Rochester radio executive and one of the best people ever in the business.
Still going strong at age 90-something.
Wow. And Nick Nixon had the deepest, boomiest voice I ever heard it was like. His voice was so deep that when he spoke, it could rip the paper out of a loudspeaker cone, you know, like, kind of like that. He did all the sports that were possible to do down in Ithaca back in those days, and later on wound up in Rochester, of course, on his way to L.A., where he's been now, I think, for 30 years, and among other things, they have named the press box in his honor at the Staples Center. So,
and I will say, Peter, that he has recently said that he grew about a decade ago to accept the fact that he would always be the voice of a lovable loser. And now, as the two-time Stanley Cup champions, he's on the gravy train now. But good for him. And you knew it at the time with that stentorian voice, huh?
Absolutely. And IC and Cornell, by the way, were a great proving grounds for great sportscasters, other than Nick, for example. I mean, I'm looking at my list here, and there are people you may have heard of, maybe you haven't heard of. Down here in Florida, we've got Eric Reed, who has done the Miami Heat broadcasts on radio and TV ever since the very first game. Well, Eric was an IC student with me. He was Eric Friedlieb back then. By the way, we don't all change our names, but a lot of us, we could talk about that sometime too. Lanny Frattari, you wanted a Rochester connection.
There we go, yeah.
Lanny Frattari went to Ithaca during the 60s, wound up being the voice of the Red Wings for a while, and wound up with the Pittsburgh Pirates for a long, long time. We have a picture of him in the book. Part of the problem we had was we couldn't find pictures from all of these people from back in the day, because not everybody had a cell phone camera the way we did back then. Frank Carpano, who has been the lead anchor at NBC's affiliate in Providence, Rhode Island for about 30 years. Chuck Wilson is a guy I love to talk about because he did ESPN radio for years. He was an Ithaca student when I was there, wound up doing really well with ESPN for a while. Now he's running a nonprofit organization out of Providence. Do you want some more names?
Well, I'm looking at the book, and I'm reminded that you talk about it's not just Ithaca, it's Cornell. Dave Ross is a voice that we've heard for years as well. And I guess Dave, was another one of those guys who very early on was very clearly going to be either a great voice, a great journalist, or both. Among many others.
And Dave Ross is now doing mornings out at our CBS affiliate out in Seattle, Cairo, KIRO, but fills in for Charles Osgood on commentaries on the network as well. And he's not just got a great voice, but a great brain. And
does he ever.
It's a reminder that, you know, it's not just how you sound, but it's, you know, what comes out of your mouth. You talked about Olbermann. Let's talk about Pam Coulter, one of my CBS coworkers, who spent a long time at ABC News, at WTOP Radio in Washington.
NPR for a little while also.
NPR for a little while, too, until coming back to CBS a few years ago. Peter Shacknow, who is not what you would call a household name, but to those of us who knew him back in the day and still know him now, he's a senior producer at CNBC, but also helped them go on the air years and years and years ago. He was an on-air newscaster in Ithaca and in Long Island and for a number of stations in the New York area before winding up at CNBC. Stacey Kahn, the same thing. It was just an amazing group of people that came through that area while I was there in that era. You say that 10 times fast.
was Olbermann, Peter, was he sort of made a career out of being obstreperous to the management no matter where he is?
He was the same way then.
Yeah.
He was the same way then, and he told me a great story of how he wanted to get hired in Ithaca at WTKO, the commercial station, and they said, oh, you'll never get hired anywhere with that attitude.
truer words were always spoken.
Indeed.
Peter King is going to be here on Thursday. I say here. He's going to be from 11:30 to 1:30 on Thursday, going to be at the Bill Gray's on Penfield Road talking about Ithaca Radio, Images of America, his new book. Scott Feibusch is here and will be out there with him as well. Scott, of course, a WXXI contributor and editor of Northeast Radio Watch. Now, Peter, in the book, Keith Olbermann makes the point that he learned a great lesson in Ithaca very early on, which is that if you just rip and read, no matter how good your radio voice is, you're doing exactly what everybody else is doing. And the funny thing now is you occasionally will see, I'm trying to remember, who's the late night host who compiles it and makes fun of, I think it's Jimmy Kimmel, makes fun of news anchors, television news anchors, ripping reading the exact
all
same
reading
copy.
The same wire script.
And, and Olbermann said he knew in the 1970s if you do that, you will not be able to carve out a good distinctive career. So the lesson for him was, write, and rewrite, and think. And what were the early lessons that you learned that you can remember?
Well, you know something, the first lesson I learned was my very first day at Ithaca College, which was on Labor Day 1974, and our first broadcast operations professor, the first class, said, well, you're learning a valuable lesson today. This is Labor Day, and we're here. There are no holidays in broadcasting. And you guys well know that that's the truth, and I think I've worked just about every holiday since 1974. But in a more serious vein, what Keith said is right. And back in those days, there was a guy at WABC who I loved because he was enthusiastic, he was passionate, he was fun to listen to, and he was the nighttime jock on WABC in New York, which is what I wanted to do. His name was George Michael, and I wanted to be the next George Michael. And I kind of emulated his style and my own. It took me a while to realize, you know, I can't be the next George Michael. I got to be the first me.
There is a room here at WXXI that is filled with old vinyl. And in Ithaca, there's a great photo in the book, in Ithaca Radio, from, I think it was from the 1980s, in which there was what looked like a temple to vinyl, ceiling to floor vinyl. And there was a disc jockey there who spent a lot of time in that room, who eventually had to change his name because there was another Danny DeVito that was a little more famous. And I loved that story, especially in light of recent weeks, Peter, because we're talking to Peter King, CBS Radio, among other things. Peter, you probably wished you had a different name in recent weeks after this NFL scandal came up, because there's another Peter King, and I take it you've been getting some nasty mail and comments online from people, haven't you?
Well, you know what? It's not just that I'm getting the hate tweets for Peter King, the Sports Illustrated writer and NBC commentator, but also Congressman Peter King. So, you know, when the Homeland Security stuff comes up, I hear from his critics. When the football stuff comes up, I mean, I've gotten slaughtered the last few weeks on the NFL. And it's like half of you just wants to say, you know, wants to ignore it. But, you know, I try and answer people and explain kindly or maybe sometimes not so kindly on Twitter that, hey, it's not me. And I even have my own hashtag. I'm not that Peter King. And it works for both of them. No, you know what? You have me on the air, and I've been on the air for 40 years as Peter King. My given last name, my legal last name, which is on the book, is something else. It's Steinhaus. And we changed our names. My brother was on the air as Ricky King, but his air name later became Rick Summers. And the Steinhaus brothers... Back in the day, program directors wanted easy-to-remember three-syllable names, which is how I came up with Peter King. The last name came from Hal King, who was a baseball player for the Cincinnati Reds back in 1974, 75 or so, a bench guy. Rick became Ricky King when he went on WTKO, just as kind of an homage to me, which I thought was very nice, and then, you know, developed his own persona and then a different name. A lot of guys in those days did that, though.
And you get the guys who are lucky enough to be born with an air name.
Scott Feibusch.
Yeah, indeed.
My friend Clark Ingram, who came through town here in Rochester a few years ago. Everybody thinks, oh, that must be an air name, right?
No, great name.
That's his name?
Great name. And the greatest real radio name I ever heard was a guy I worked with in Syracuse named Ray DiOrio. It sang to you. And literally in our jingle at WHEN, Ray DiOrio. It sounded wonderful. If I had known that I was going to wind up on the network and be heard from coast to coast, I never would have changed my name. But, you know, 1975, 76, when you're getting your first professional gigs, you do what you got to do.
No, you do what you're told. The book is Ithaca Radio. Scott Feibusch, how do you see the landscape changing? And obviously in 40 years, a lot has changed. But what has changed... I don't want to say for the worst, but what disappoints you?
I think one of the challenges now for anybody who thinks, hey, I can go to college and do this now too, is that the landscape of what awaits you after college has changed so dramatically. You know, there was a time, whether you went to Cornell or Ithaca College, or maybe you graduated from Geneseo or Brockport or Buffalo State, there were all kinds of stations you could go to right out of college without a lot of experience that desperately needed lots of people all day long. And you could go and you could be the guy doing news from 7 to midnight, or you could be on air overnight. And there were these opportunities to learn and, you know, frankly, to screw up somewhere along the way and make those mistakes before you hit the big time. And a lot of that opportunity, I think, and Peter, you can speak to this, I'm sure, too. A lot of those opportunities aren't there anymore because these stations that once needed live people now have a rack of computers that are doing that job.
And let me take that one step backwards, because so many of us in those days and now too got started while we were in school. I mean, I went to school with a lot of people who worked either in town or got weekend gigs in places like Syracuse, Rochester, Elmira, Binghamton, so they could get some professional call letters on their resumes before they graduated. And me, you know, I worked at TKO for the last part of my sophomore and my junior and senior years. So I was getting that valuable commercial experience while I was still in school. And at WOLF in Syracuse, Scott, the last time I saw you was at a reunion of that legendary radio station almost a decade ago. I mean, it gave us all a head start, and now there are not as many opportunities for you to work while you're in school so you can get those commercial calls, because the jobs are fewer and farther between thanks to satellite automation and everything else. So
I did Saturday mornings my senior year of college. I got up every Saturday morning at 4 and went up and did news in Lowell, Massachusetts,
because
it was a job and it paid $5 an hour.
Hey, $5 an hour. I was making 2.25 at TKO. I think I made $2.50 at Wolf in Syracuse per hour.
This was into the early 90s. The index for inflation, we were probably just about in the same boat at that point.
But
I think at TKO, I would have probably still been making $2.75 in the 90s.
The logical follow-up then, Scott and Peter, is when you talk to students now and for example, we've had plenty of interns come through here at WXXI. I previously was in commercial television news, and we've had plenty of interns who asked the question, should I stay in this industry? And they're often telling me that they're being counseled sometimes by their own professors, but sometimes also by people in the industry that they meet during internships. Do something else, you know, unless you're independently wealthy or, you know, you love working holidays and weekends. I always tell them hard work still wins, but it is harder to stand out and to do that. And let me start with you, Peter. When you talk to students today and they wonder if this is the right career path anymore, what do you tell them?
I tell them that they have to follow their head and their heart, but they also have to use common sense. Here's the thing. Everybody today is being asked to do much, much more with much, much less. In reporting now, you're not just going out and gathering your quotes, or if you're a radio reporter, gathering your sound and putting together a story that goes on the radio. You're taking pictures, you're tweeting, sometimes you're Facebooking, you're possibly writing a story for your station's website. What am I leaving out here? Sometimes shooting video. And the thing that's kept me going for years and years and years, and this is a formula that I think still works, you've got to be able to do a lot of different things. Because if you can do a lot of different things, you're not a one-trick pony. And if you're able to do a lot of different things, you're showing your value to your employer. And if they say, if somebody said at budget time is saying, well, you know what, you know, this guy, do we need him? Your manager possibly could go say, well, look, he does A, B, C, D, E, F, and G. He does all these things. He's a valuable player. We want him. And that's one of the things that kept me employed, except for the couple times that I got fired. And we can talk about that, too. And it's one of the things that I think keeps me going today is that, you know, you could parachute into any situation, change direction on a moment's notice, and be able to do it well. You've got to be able to punt. You've got to be able to anticipate the need, and you have to have the skill to be able to do it. You can't just put yourself in one corner and say, this is what I do, and this is all I'm doing.
But before I turn that question to Scott, does that jack of all trades mean master of none? Is there a concern that you are spending so much time trying to do everything that you can't specialize in the way that maybe broadcasters used to?
Well, not at all, because I'm great at all of it.
I'm not talking about you personally. No. I know you are.
Look, the days, and I'm not, believe me, let me tell you, I make more than my share of mistakes. But my point is that you have to be able to do a little bit of everything. I mean, being a reporter these days, you can't be a specialist anymore. I'd love to say, hey, I'm a space reporter, and that's what I do. But guess what? The space shuttle stopped flying 3 years ago. We're not flying another human-rated vehicle from here in Florida for another 3 years or so. And you can't make a living on network radio as a space reporter. Did I get really good at that? Yeah, I did. Could I get better? Yeah, but that's kind of how I made my mark here. That said, you're going to be able to do all the other stuff. And it's part of, look, I feel like at CBS, I'm on the best bench in the business. You know, it's kind of like being on the 27 Yankees. But you have to be able to contribute and to do a lot of different things. And it's not that you don't do any of them particularly well. It's that you can do a really decent job at a lot of things and be able to change direction. And, you know, that's what we do in radio. At least our version of radio is spot news. And that means changing directions and adapting. And, you know, if they need you to do an update on short notice or a special report, you have to know to be able to do that. If they need to send you traveling on short notice, you got to be packed and ready to go. If you get the call at 3 a.m. that says, hey, somebody got sick, we need you to anchor the morning shift, you got to fall out of bed and be ready to do it. This is how it works. You know, the more you can do, the more valuable you are.
What do you think, Scott?
I think one of the things, you know, when I get asked that question now, one of the answers that I give is you have to be comfortable knowing that there is absolutely no certainty about what the industry is going to look like even 5 or 10 years down the road. It was a lot simpler when Peter was in college, even when I got out of college. you know, you knew that you could go from an Ithaca, come up and work in a Rochester or a Syracuse for 5 or 10 years and have a very decent shot of going on and working Philadelphia or working New York City or working Boston. And it's not like that anymore, because you have no idea now what this industry is even going to look like 5 or 10 years from now. There is still a demand out there for some form of interesting, engaging audio content. But the venues have changed, the nature of the content has changed, and you've got to be prepared for the idea that whatever it is you're going to be doing 10 years from now probably hasn't even been invented at this point.
Yeah.
And if you want more certainty than that, then go back to school and learn how to originate mortgages or something.
Yeah.
I think that's go ahead, Peter.
And that's really exciting. Not as a put down of people who originate mortgages, but, you know, if you get something like this in your blood, it's in your blood, and often enough, it stays in your blood, and you want to stay in the business one way or another. But it's always changing, and it's changing faster than any of us ever anticipated, Scott, isn't it?
It is. We should mention, by the way, for people who are scratching their head saying, wait, Peter King, I've heard that name on Rochester radio, too. We haven't pointed out that you were here in this market for a little while also.
I was. I worked there from 1990 to 1993 at a station called WKLX. It was 98.9. Well, I don't even know what call letters on that
these days. They're over there.
The
our neighbors
buzz.
Behind us on Commercial Street. Yeah.
Well, and let me begin to wrap the conversation with this, Peter. You mentioned covering the space program, and yes, you can sort of poke fun at the fact that you're covering a program that has really dramatically changed or been downscaled in different ways, but there's still a fascination with what NASA's doing, public-private partnerships, and the plan for future exploration, whatever form it takes. Give me a sense for the way you view that industry.
Well, first of all, it was a necessary evolution because government can't be the be-all, end-all, and space is an expensive business. And with NASA being pulled in so many directions, there was almost no direction. So it totally makes sense. I miss the shuttle. I need to say that right off. And as I sit here, I look at pictures of me covering the end of the very last shuttle mission just over 3 years ago. I did more than 60 of them, by the way, for CBS. And it was, you know, childhood dream come true, if you will, to be able to cover space then and now. The direction changes. In another 3 years, we expect to have commercial operators flying their own ships to the International Space Station. In another 5 to 6 years, we expect NASA to fly a human spacecraft that it will hopefully have take our astronauts into deep space. It's going to be exciting. It has been exciting to cover and watch, and it's going to be exciting when we get those first human launches from the Cape again in another couple of years.
Yeah, and hopefully no more tragedy. And that's got to be one of the harder parts of the job. I mean, as journalists, you're trained to put your head down and cover what's going on in front of you.
I was on the air the day Columbia came down. Yeah. I was not here and not doing this when Challenger happened. But, you know, that was in many ways the worst day because of the tragedy of losing seven brave Americans. For journalism, it was a good day because we got it right and we didn't speculate and we just let the story unfold. And what happened after that, you know, the investigation of the whole nine yards, well, we don't want to go through all of that now, but that's part of it. And lives will still be lost. There will be more accidents.
What was the Columbia day like?
Well, you know, we kind of went there expecting a normal landing, and I went on and did a live shot at 9 o'clock that morning, and when I got off the air, listening to Mission Control call up to Columbia and getting no response, you know, my first thought was, uh-oh. I go into the next room where my colleague Bill Harwood is on standby for TV, and he looked at me and said, dude, I don't think they're coming back, and he was right. And, you know, all you can do, you're flying by the seat of your pants because nobody ever writes a manual for this stuff. And you're listening to Mission Control. You're trying not to speculate. You're trying not to be an alarmist. You don't know who's listening. You don't know. What you don't know is as important as what you do know. So, you know, you just kind of hold it together and just say, this is what we know. There's a lot that we don't know. Stay with us. And gradually, we pulled in more people. We pulled all the pieces together. And it became a long, long odyssey through the investigation and figuring out how to get the shuttle program back into space. It was, you know, an awful time because of the tragedy, but it was an exciting time for watching the process of how they investigated this and how they figured out what they were going to do next.
I've been talking to Peter King from CBS Radio, and the book is Ithaca Radio. And Peter King and Scott Feibusch are going to be out at the Bill Gray's on Penfield Road on Thursday from 11:30 to 1:30, signing books, talking radio, talking about the industry, sharing some stories. The great storytellers still stand out. And Peter, that's you. We love your voice, and the book's great. It's Ithaca Radio. Thank you for taking the time.
Are you kidding? Thank you for having me on. It was great to be on with you, and we hope to see a lot of old friends and some new friends out at Bill Gray's in Penfield on Thursday.
We'll
it's very exciting
we
time.
We will see you Thursday. Scott Feibusch, thank you as well.
Always a pleasure.
All right, short break now, and when we come back, I'm a little bit of a radio assignment for you. Think about your favorite place to escape to in Western New York. Maybe it's a small street. Maybe it's a quaint little spot. A small town, a comfort food that you love to go grab. You know, what's if you had a day or an afternoon to yourself, what is that peaceful, quaint spot, the kind of spot that you love introducing other people to? I want you to think about that. And that is the seed for our conversation next hour, is we're going to try to slow things down and appreciate what's around us on Connection. Stay with us.